history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories out there just waiting to be heard if you know the right questions to ask and you take the time to listen. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to make sure that we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and oftentimes inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Visalia, California, home for the last 30 years to 97-year-old Simeon Deming, a veteran of both the U.S. Navy and the Army Air Corps, which turned into the Air Force. Quite a story we're going to hear today. It involves the USS Arizona. It involves P-38 Lightnings, a Purple Heart, a Distinguished Flying Cross. But I'm going to go way back before any of that. If you can remember back this far, 97 years is a long time to remember. But growing up in Oregon, Forest Grove, Oregon, with an older brother, what was life like as a boy out there?
Wow. I don't think it was anything special, just growing up.
I know Portland wasn't as crowded back then. You didn't have this huge metropolis like you have
there today. No, yeah. It was an honor to get to go to Portland. That was 40 miles away.
How'd you get there? Horse and buggy?
Well, no, we had Model T.
Do you remember, as a boy, having some ideas, hey, when I grow up, I'm going to do this and this?
No, I don't think so. I don't recall anything like that.
You're busy playing sports, I guess, huh?
Yeah, I love sports. I think I was in all of them.
Were you pretty good?
Yeah. They left me on a team, let's put it that way.
Uh-huh. What do you think your best sport was?
Probably baseball.
What position did you play?
Third base.
So you're playing baseball. You've got a big brother. Did you feel out there in Oregon the effects of the Great Depression?
Well, I didn't. My dad always had a job and always had something to eat, so I guess really I didn't.
What kinds of things did you do for fun?
Swimming, tennis, I don't know.
Uh-huh. How did it come about that you thought joining the Navy was a good idea?
Well, there was no work and you couldn't find a job anyplace, and that was, you know, 3 meals a day and a little bit of money in your pocket, so that's what I did.
You were 18?
Yeah.
Did you have any idea what to expect out of the Navy?
Nope.
Did you have any inclination that war might be coming?
No, not at all. Not then.
So tell me about it. What was your welcome to the Navy? What did they do to you to break you in?
A lot of marching and a lot of rules and regulations. That's things that you're not used to.
Uh-huh. Did you have a preference as to what kind of ship you ended up on?
No, none at all. I just wanted to go someplace where I could make some money. If you remember back in 1937, 10 cents was a lot of money.
Yeah. What could you buy with 10 cents in 1937?
You'd buy a regular meal.
Yeah. So you join the Navy, 1937. They end up putting you on a battleship. In fact, right in front of you right now is a leather-bound logbook that says USS Arizona. Now, of course, we know that might be the most famous ship in the world.
Yeah.
It's still there at Pearl Harbor?
Still there.
Sailors still entombed on that ship from December 7, 1941. But we're talking about 1937 when you go in the Navy, so years before that. What was life on the Arizona like? What'd you do on that ship?
Just routine. You had a job to do, and you did your job and stayed out of people's way.
Uh-huh. So what was your job on the ship?
I was a radio operator.
So where's that duty station?
That was in the bowels of the ship, clear at the bottom.
How'd you like that?
I didn't.
A little hot down there?
Yeah, it was hot, and, well, you're really entombed.
Yeah, if anything happens to the ship.
Yeah, you'd be there.
So as a radio operator on the Arizona, what did that mean you had to do? Who are you communicating with?
I guess with all the ships in the Navy, mainly. You know, you sent messages and received messages, and all military.
Some people might not have any idea. What is a battleship doing when there's no war? What kinds of things did you guys do in 38 and 39 and 40?
Well, they still had practices, and you know, they shot their guns off at targets and played like there was a war.
And you guys would go up and down the West Coast?
Yes, and over to Hawaii and Australia, and moved around pretty good.
I know being a radio guy and being down in the radio shack might sound kind of lonely, but did you build some friendships, relationships with other sailors?
Oh, yeah, sure, certainly. Real good friendships.
And again, you have no inclination, no suggestion that war might be coming, even when you're going out into the Pacific?
No, I don't think there was any inclination of war at that time.
Did you figure you'd stay on this ship forever?
Or? No, I think I just planned on being there for my 4 years and trying something else.
So when did you get off the Arizona?
July 1940.
So a little more than a year before Pearl Harbor happened. But I'm just guessing that a lot of the guys that were on that ship the day you left...
They're still there.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of them.
So we'll come back to that. I want to follow your story. So you get out of the Navy. You've done a 4-year enlistment.
Yes.
You've done your duty. You've made some money. Now what?
I went to work for Lockheed.
Why'd you do that?
It's the only job I could find.
Likely story. I've talked to a lot of people that worked in that plant, even some women who were working that plant, eventually assembling aircraft. This is down in Southern California?
Yes, Burbank.
Right by all the movie stars down there.
They had a heck of a time keeping me out of the movies.
I wonder how they pulled that off. Somebody burned your screen test, I guess. So what were you doing at Lockheed?
I was a riveter, a head riveter.
And again, this is before the war.
Yes.
Because people hear riveter in the war and they think of some lady named Rosie.
That's right. I was building P-38, which is what I flew.
Yeah. So Lockheed has this newfangled aircraft called the P-38 Lightning. And you're in there in the factory riveting in the fuselage together or something?
Yeah. I worked in the wing sections.
The wings. All right. Was that hard work? Easy work?
Yeah, it was kind of hard. Because some places wasn't too easy to get into, you know.
And is it occurring to you yet that if you're making all these warplanes, maybe we are going to be in a war eventually?
Well, I'm sure they expected a war because England was already in the war. So.
And we're sending them equipment.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you personally, did you think this was coming?
Oh, no. Not at that time.
So what do you remember about December 7th, 1941?
That's a really strange one because a buddy of mine that was in the Navy in Pearl Harbor was home, and I took him and his wife to Las Vegas to get married.
Wow. Good thing he was home.
Yeah.
So you were in Las Vegas on December 7th.
Yes.
So how did you find out what happened?
Well, I guess we heard on the radio. I'm not, you know, it is.
So you're hearing Pearl Harbor has been bombed.
It says report back to base immediately.
And unlike most Americans, you knew where Pearl Harbor was.
Yes, I did.
You'd been there.
Yeah.
But I imagine immediately, in that moment, they don't have any details about which ships are hit. You just know there's been damage.
Right. That's correct. My buddy that was getting married was still stationed on the Arizona.
Wow.
So he had no place to report back to.
Yeah. Boy, there's a wedding that saved his life.
Yeah, it did.
So when you found out how badly damaged the Arizona was and that 1,177 of her crew were killed, how did that strike you? How did you...
Well, I was awfully glad I wasn't on it. But, yeah, you had some pretty bad feelings because, you know, so many of your own buddies are there. So.
And I'm not trying to pry, and I don't want to make it harder for you than it is, but is that a situation where there are specific guys who come to mind and you're waiting to find out if they made it or not?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, sure. After spending 4 years out there, you have a lot of good buddies.
Did any of your good buddies make it out alive?
No.
Wow.
The only one that made it out was the one that was with me. So
He
had no place to go back to. His ship was gone.
Yeah.
So
what was his name?
Joe Wilt. He was from Nebraska.
I'm just trying to understand, because very few people have a story like you have here. Can you describe the emotions you felt as a result of what happened? I mean, here are all these guys that you'd served with are killed in a surprise attack.
Well, you don't feel very good about it. The fact is, you want to get a gun and go get them.
And a lot of people don't realize what Los Angeles, you're in Burbank, the greater L.A. area, what things were like there right after Pearl Harbor. You guys had blackouts? You had?
Oh, yes. Well, there was, I don't think people knew about it, but they actually, they got bombed right after Pearl Harbor.
By Santa Barbara,
yeah,
right?
Uh-huh,
they had some shells
right,
that hit.
Yes.
But you guys don't know if there's a land invasion coming?
Well, you got to, they expected it.
You had people operating spotlights?
Yes, right.
In the hills? And even your plant, the Lockheed plant, employed camouflage. They made it look like it was a green hill or something,
yes, they
right?
did. You couldn't see it from the air at all.
did that add a little urgency to the work you're doing there?
Well, I guess we all tried to do a good job. I didn't know at the time I was building B-38s, and that's what I flew.
Yeah, it's quite a story. How long, though, did you stay there at the plant putting these aircraft together?
Not too long, because I just had to go back into service.
Did they make you, or did you decide on your own?
They wouldn't let me. I had to do it on my own.
Well, I was going to say, they probably thought you were essential in what
they
were doing.
Yes.
And you didn't have to go. You could have stayed out.
Absolutely.
You could have had an exemption.
That's right, yes.
So why was that so important to you?
I don't know. I guess I felt I had to do something.
Was it for the guys on the Arizona? Was it for the country?
I don't know. It was just a feeling you had that you know you want to go do your part, that's all.
And I imagine as you leave, and this is just a microcosm of what was happening nationwide, you leave that job of riveting the airplanes, and Rosie comes in. Probably a lot of women that came in and did the job that you were doing.
That's very true. That's what happened, yes.
And what made you decide you wanted to fly?
I don't know.
Had you ever flown before?
Well, I flew as a crew member, as a radio operator on planes, yeah.
Some Navy planes.
Yeah, Navy planes. But I guess I thought I'd made the P-38s. I thought I wanted to fly one.
I'm sure a lot of people that worked on those P-38s would like to fly them, but most of them didn't have the opportunity, and there are a lot of hurdles you have to clear in order to fly them.
Yes.
What can you tell me about your training in the Army Air Corps, that journey to become a pilot?
Well, first thing, it's really strange, but if you didn't have 2 years of college, you had to go back to college. You have 2 years of college before you could fly.
Mm-hmm.
I've never quite understood that, but anyway, they did. They sent me back to college, Ellensburg at Washington. Nice little town.
Is that Central Washington? Is that
yeah,
what that is?
Yeah, uh-huh. Central Washington, yes.
All right.
And then I got into cadets.
Meanwhile, your brother gets sent overseas.
Oh, he was already South Pacific, yeah.
Uh-huh. So he's in the Army.
Yeah.
Were you concerned about him? Were you worried that he might not come back?
You don't have any you don't think about it. I don't think I ever thought about it.
Even after you lost all these friends on December 7th?
You don't think it that way. At least I never did.
What was the most challenging aspect of your training to become a pilot?
I don't know. I guess flying came easy to me. A lot of people had trouble, but I didn't.
Even all the book work?
Yeah, the book work got nasty, but I never had any trouble. It always came easy to me.
And I'm sure the P-38 wasn't the only plane you had the opportunity to fly. What were some of the others that you got in the cockpit of?
Oh, gosh. All kinds of steermans and read them off.
You got a list right here, huh? And you even have it categorized by the number of hours that you've spent in all these. From the old PT-17 to the BT-13, the B-25, the P-38. 400 hours in those, even the big old C-47 and some of the other fighter trainings like the AT-6. There's even a jet on here. Got the F-80 on here. B-17, it's quite a collection of aircraft you've been in.
It's really strange. Every base you go to has a different airplane. So if you want to fly, you just about have to check out in their airplane.
So you've got bombers, fighters, cargo planes on here, C-45, C-47. Of all the aircraft that you got to fly in the Army Air Corps and then in a long career in the Air Force and the Reserve, what was your favorite?
P-38.
You don't want to think about that any longer? It's that quick off the top of your tongue. There's no doubt.
It was a wonderful airplane.
Well, and you're partial to it from having put them together at the Lockheed plant. Then you finally get to fly them. Tell me about the first time you got in the cockpit of that P-38.
Oh, my God. I can remember I took off faster than I should have. I gave it too much throttle. So I took off about halfway down the base instead of, you know, using the whole bay. So I took off. Then coming in for landing, it seemed like I must have gone out 3 miles for the landing pattern.
Getting a feel for it.
Yeah.
Was that a personal thrill for you to finally get up in one of those after you
put
them together?
Oh, yeah, you bet. Absolutely.
And what was it about that plane and its capabilities that you appreciated?
Well, it was fast, it was maneuverable, it was a good airplane.
And by the time you're flying it, this is 1944, I guess, they'd kind of worked out some of the kinks.
Oh, yeah. Well, the ones they started with, the ones they gave to England, they had both the propellers went both in the same direction. The ones we flew had counter-rotating propellers, so it had no torque at all.
Well, and that the guys that flew the ones that both turned in the same direction found out the hard way what that could lead to.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they were really hard to take off because, you know, you had all that torque up to the right. But we had no torque. You could just point them down the runway and push the throttles the way you went.
And a lot of guys died figuring that out.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so good thing you didn't have to deal with that. So this is Halloween 1944 when you finish your photo recon training in a P-38 in Oklahoma. You're heading overseas. Did you have an idea of what you'd be doing over there?
No, have no idea where you're going or anything. You just pack your bag, you're going.
Well, we'll find out where he ended up when we come back. We'll hear about the mission that earned him a Purple Heart, as well as the one that left him floating down in a parachute over enemy territory. To see photos of Sim Deming then and now, head over to the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's visit with 97-year-old Sim Deming of Visalia, California. He flew F-5s, that's what they called P-38s, outfitted with cameras instead of guns, with the 12th Photo Reconnaissance Squadron, part of the 3rd Reconnaissance Group, flying out of Italy in World War II.
And this idea of flying photo reconnaissance, you're flying a fighter plane. You look like a fighter plane, you sound like a fighter plane, but there's one big difference.
There's a big difference. You don't have those guns.
You've got no guns.
No guns. The reason they took the guns off was because people wouldn't take the pictures. They used their guns, so they took the guns off from them.
So you have no choice.
No choice. That's right. You either did yourself or got in trouble.
And you're going into Europe against an enemy and a Luftwaffe who had singled out the P-38 as probably their most hated enemy plane.
Absolutely.
They called it what, the fork-tailed devil or something like that?
I've forgotten, but I think it was the Messerschmitt we hated the worst.
Yeah, but they hated your plane as much as anything else. And I'm guessing if they see the profile of a P-38, they're not going to say, oh, let's wait and see if he has guns or not.
Well, I think they probably did, yeah.
Tell me about the kind of missions you flew. How did you understand the job that you had?
I don't know how to explain that.
What would you typically be looking for?
Well, we took pictures of their munitions, you know, of the trains that hauled their munitions, and we took pictures of their bases, and whatever they wanted to take, that's what we took. You didn't argue with them.
You know, folks who listen to this show, they've heard a lot of bomber pilots, they've heard a lot of fighter pilots. The bombers, they're always flying in formation. They've always got help. Sometimes they even have fighter escorts. For you guys, flying a photo recon mission, are you flying with other P-38s or by yourself?
Normally you're by yourself, but you mentioned the bombers. A lot of times we had to follow them in and take pictures of what they did.
So you're right in behind a formation of bombers.
Yeah, we're just getting, by the time we got there, the people were mad on the ground and they were shooting at you.
Well, yeah. And you know, it's hard to miss a squadron of bombers coming in.
That
kind of draws a little attention.
Yes.
Especially when they drop their payload. So typically your mission, you're the only P-38 going?
Oh, yeah, you're alone.
And how frequently would you say you're flying one like that where you're out to take pictures of what the bombers do?
Well, not too often that. Normally we were just taking pictures of armament, and, you know, what we were going to bomb the next day and things like that. It was something special when we followed the bombers in.
And so in a situation like that where you're scouting out potential targets.
Yeah.
You're all by yourself?
Oh, yes.
There's nobody else in the sky?
Nobody else.
There's nobody to talk to?
Let's put it another way. Yeah. There wasn't supposed to be anybody else.
If there is, it's probably not one of yours.
That's right.
How do you prepare yourself for a mission like that?
You just go.
Did you feel like it was dangerous work?
I don't think so. We knew we were better pilots than they were. So.
You said that very convincingly. How do they brief you for a mission like that?
Well, they tell you what they want you to take and what to expect.
They give you a little map or something?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You always had a map of where you were going. And normally they knew what kind of armament was there, but that didn't always work out either.
Yeah. And I want to hear some of those stories. And what kind of altitude are you flying at?
Normally 25,000.
So you're high up there.
Yeah.
But doesn't mean you're unreachable.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah. No, not at all.
So you're flying 25,000 feet, and then when you get over the target that you're supposed to photograph, how do you do that? How do you take the photos?
Well, you have a map of the area you want to go, and maybe you might have to go over the target four, five, six times. So you just pick a heading, and you stay on it until you get it done.
And how many cameras were mounted on your P-38?
We just had one big one on the nose, right under the nose.
Okay. And then you've got a little button you press to snap the shutter?
Yeah. I think it was a 40-inch camera.
So you fly over, you snap a couple, circle back around.
Do it again, yeah.
And you don't need to give me a percentage or anything, but how frequent was it on one of these missions that you encountered anti-aircraft fire?
Quite frequently, yes. And if it got too bad, you just broke off and got out of there. But naturally, the pictures are very important, so you stayed as long as you dared, you know. When the shells got to coming through the canopy, you left.
If you could.
Yeah.
And you've got both sides of that. I think you've got one where you could and one where you couldn't quite do it the way you wanted to. Let's talk about your Purple Heart. You've got a display of medals here from your long military career, and that Purple Heart is hard to miss. What happened that day?
Well, I don't know. I don't think I probably should have got the Purple Heart. I could show you the scar.
Yeah, right on the back of your head.
Yeah, right there.
I see it. Yeah, yeah. Right at the base of your skull. That's not a sensitive spot.
And I had a little one here. It's on my cheek.
All right.
So that's all.
Tell me what happened. You're flying. You're getting ready to take some pictures?
Yeah, well, a flak comes inside the canopy for some reason. I don't understand how it got in there, but it comes around.
Likely story. So you're flying in, and are you seeing bursts of flak around
you? Oh, my God, yeah. You could get out and walk on it.
And this was a routine thing. You're used to seeing flak in front of you.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You just see it explode in a black puff of smoke in front of you or something?
Well, sometimes it'd be just absolute like a cloud ahead of you. But you didn't worry about that. The ones that worried about it is the single ones that got, you know.
The ones that haven't exploded
yet. Yeah. They explode inside.
And that's what happened to you.
That's what happened, yeah.
So you're flying. You know there's flak in the area. You can see it.
Oh, yeah.
And
then
you feel it.
Well, you know, you don't really, I don't think you do feel it. You're too busy.
So what happened?
Well, this one came up through the bottom of the plane and exploded right in the cockpit. So I was very lucky that I just got little pieces of it, you know.
So it explodes in the cockpit. You get some on the front of your face and the back of your head.
Right.
Were you in pain?
You're too busy. You know, no, you're not in pain.
You're still focused on trying to get these photos taken.
Yeah, you don't. Well, you've quit taking pictures. You're trying to get out of there now.
And if this happens on a bomber, you got 9 or 10 other guys who can help you out and give you first aid.
That's true, yeah.
You don't have anybody.
Nobody.
Were you starting to wonder if you were going to make it home from that mission?
I don't think so. I don't think you ever worried about it. You're too busy. You know, you don't have time to think.
And you can't really check yourself out, right? Other than feeling it? Feeling the back of your head?
Well, I knew it was blood, you know, but other than that, I don't think I can't really say it hurt because I think you're too excited. Mm. You know, you don't feel the pain. But I knew I was bleeding. I didn't know I was bleeding back here. I knew I was bleeding here.
Up front.
I had a cut over my eye, too. That bothered a little bit.
And I'm sure you're wondering, what kind of shape your aircraft is in.
Well, I think you kind of knew.
It's still flying.
Yeah, as long as they're flying, you don't try to get out. You know, that's...
So what'd you do?
You go home, land the thing, and get out of it.
What do they say to you when you bring her in?
Well, you have to make a report and tell them what happened. And
what was the damage that you saw on the plane?
Oh, sometimes there were... I was trying to remember that. One of them had a couple hundred holes in the wings, anyway. There was a lot of holes. But, hey, as long as they're flying, why, you know.
Well, this is another question. I mean, here this anti-aircraft fire explodes in your cockpit. It cuts you in three places on your head. But what if that shell had come through in a little different spot on the plane?
Well, you'd have probably bailed out or depend on what, you know.
And the P-38 was not an easy plane to bail out of.
No, it was not. It was very difficult to bail out of. You had to drop upside down and fall out. Otherwise, they got caught on the tail.
A lot of guys did that.
Yes.
A lot of guys were killed bailing out,
yes.
Impaled on the tail
yeah.
of the P-38.
Yeah, the only way you could get out of it, you had to turn it upside down and drop out.
And so you didn't want to have to do that, ever?
Not unless you have to.
So you get down on this Purple Heart mission. You get back down on the ground. And the way you're talking about it, this is like no big deal.
Well, it's not. I mean, it's an everyday occurrence, you know.
When you did take stock of your injuries or grasp the
scope. Oh, you kind of get weak in the knees.
Yeah?
Yeah. And they always give you a shot of whiskey straight. I don't know what they call it, bourbon or anyways, a shot of whiskey. You had to take this.
When you got back.
When you got back.
When you go through a mission like that. Because, I mean, let's think about it. You get hit right above the eye. Right next to your mouth, and at the base of your skull. Those are three areas where if it's an inch off,
yeah.
You might not have an eye.
That's true.
You might not have a mouth. You might not have a brain.
Might not have a head.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think you think of it.
But what about flying the next mission?
That was a little difficult. It really was. But once you get to going, well, you're all right. It just first few minutes, it was a little difficult.
And you flew 43 of these photo recon missions that they gave you credit for. You flew a couple in B-25s also, outfitted with cameras?
Yeah, quite a few that we didn't get credit for, yeah. And then I think I flew 10 training missions. They called them training missions, so you didn't get credit for them, but they were just as bad as anything else.
But the enemy wasn't firing training bullets. They weren't firing
No, they
blanks.
Weren't, you know. You didn't get credit for those because those are training missions. They said, that's not a bad area. You know, those bullets won't kill you. They'll just tear holes in you.
As far as the different places where you were flying and photographing, how big of a geographical area was that? Was it all in Italy? Was it in different countries?
Yeah, no, this was all in Italy, yeah. And anywhere from the Po Valley on north, the rest of that whole area. Depends on where they were going to have their next strike, you know. So they wanted pictures of the area, so we were it.
And where were you flying out of?
Mostly Florence. The biggest part of it was out of Florence.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it was out of Naples, and you know, but the biggest part was Florence.
And how often would you fly?
Oh, sometimes every day, sometimes every other day.
And how long are you in the air on one of these missions?
Well, that's one thing we weren't. About an hour, as our missions were only about an hour, where the bombers were 13 hours.
Yeah.
Covering the same area.
And in the Pacific, the P-38... pilots were flying much longer missions.
Yeah, because it is a longer area to get there. See, we were always what they call frontline cover. So 5 minutes after we took off, we were over enemy lines.
Mm-hmm.
So an hour flying there was all over enemy lines.
Yeah. No, thank you.
Yeah.
Have you heard the story about Charles Lindbergh and the P-38s during World War II?
Not the P-38.
Some say he actually was an ace in a P-38, but he was flying non-combat missions.
Well, I knew that, but I didn't think he flew the P-38.
He did. He doubled the range of it in the Pacific. He figured out how to throttle the fuel back or something like that. From what I've read, the upshot of it was that he actually doubled the range of it. But there's some interesting stuff that's been written about that where they say he actually shot down enemy planes technically as a non-combatant.
Yeah.
He was supposed to be flying an unarmed P-38.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, 43 missions. Getting shot out just about every time?
Not every time.
But pretty close.
Pretty close, yeah.
And we've been talking about anti-aircraft fire, and that's what the Purple Heart came from. Did you ever have a case where an enemy fighter came in your neck of the woods.
Yes.
Tell me about it. I mean, because to me, this would be the scariest thing, because you can't defend yourself.
Well, let's just say I think we were better pilots. That's the only thing I can lay it to. Because when they jump you, they're close, you know. So you just have to outfly them. That's all there is to it.
And this is one enemy plane, two, three?
No, as far as I'm concerned, it was just one.
But one who has guns, and you don't have guns.
Yeah, and you don't know he's there until he starts shooting at you.
So you're flying along, and all of a sudden you see some machine gun bullets whizzing past you?
Yeah.
So what do you do? How do you get away from them?
Well, you didn't do it.
I mean, are there some special maneuvers that you could rely on?
I guess I just always poured the coal to it and did maybe a slow roll or, you know, something like that to get away from him. So once you get away from him, we could outrun him.
This was a ME-109 or something that was coming at you?
Yeah.
So you knew that you had a plane that could fly faster?
Oh, yeah. That's the main thing. You just had to get away from him, yeah. You know, there's lots of tricks you could do, and the main thing is, I guess, is speed. Of course, you can cut the throttle, too, but I'm not so sure that would work so good.
Well, what if he cuts your throttle with a bullet?
Yeah,
and
that's
then
what
you're
I'm saying.
Duck?
Yeah, that might work, it might not.
Well, and again, I mean, you're chuckling about this, and you're talking about it like it's not life or death, but this is life or death.
It is, but you know, you don't think of it that way, because I guess it's a way of life. You're doing it practically every day, and I won't say you get used to it, but I guess you do get used to it, you know.
And I guess you were a pretty old man. I mean, you're all at 25.
I was an old man.
Comparatively speaking,
yes.
To other guys around,
yes.
I'm sure. Well, there was one of those missions where you got shot down.
Well, all you can do is bail out and close your eyes and hope for you go someplace. I landed in an area where there was some haystacks or whatever it was, and I just crawled in one of them and covered myself up.
Well, there's a lot more to the story than that, but we need to take another break. If you head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, you'll find a short video of Mr. Deming talking about this mission, and you'll hear it straight from this 97-year-old himself when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Sim Deming is our guest today. Like many of the veterans you hear on this program, he was initially hesitant to share his story. I don't know about you, but I'm thankful he decided to take us back to his World War II experiences today. We've heard about his time on the USS Arizona, leaving that ill-fated ship about a year and a half before the attack on Pearl Harbor. He told us about the shell that came through the bottom of his F-5, the unarmed reconnaissance version of the P-38 Lightning, and he even described the head wounds that left him with. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find photos of Sim in the Navy, in the Army Air Corps, and his favorite photos, the ones with his late wife, Mary. The photographs he was taking from the skies over Italy on April 3rd, 1945, would never be seen because he was shot down by German forces. And we're going to hear that full story now. Was it an enemy airplane that got you, or was it from the ground?
I would say it's from the ground, because normally the fighters, you see them coming and you get out of there, you know. But
yeah.
But the ground fire is another story, because you could be flying along there and all of a sudden the ground, the sky is just black.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say it was from the ground.
So are you at You're up there at 25,000 feet when you got hit?
Yeah.
Tell me about it. Tell me what you remember about that day.
I think the first thing I did was just kind of rolled out of there, and then when I got down maybe 10,000 feet, I just bailed out.
So you knew instantly that you were hit badly you weren't going to get back.
Oh, yeah, yeah. When your engines quit running.
Both of them stopped?
They sputter, you know.
So you know you're in trouble.
Oh, yeah. You can't
keep going like that for long.
You don't argue with them.
And had you prepared yourself for this happening sometime? Had you considered the possibility?
I don't think you do, no. How can you prepare yourself for something like that? And you know, when it happens, everything happens so fast that you're not scared. You don't have time to get scared. Afterwards, now, that's another story. When you and I are sitting around having a beer the next day, that's when your knees go.
If you're around to do that.
That's a big if.
So, sorry for all the questions. I just want to make sure everybody understands that we understand what this was like here. So, you're shot up. Your engines are sputtering. You realize you're going to have to bail out. But you've never bailed out of a P-38 before.
You don't bail out of them because if you do, there's only one way to get out of them. You got to roll it over and drop out. Otherwise, you hit that tail seize.
Right, because if you just go over the side, by the time you come down, the tail's going to be caught up.
That's
it's
right.
It's going to slice you in half.
And then you don't need to worry.
That's right. Put you out of your misery right there.
Yeah.
But, so what I'm after, had you ever practiced that before? Have you ever practiced?
Yes, we did practice it, but it's so different. They put a mock airplane up here 50 feet in the air.
Uh-huh.
There's a tower there, and some way they've got cables, and you jump out on these cables. That's supposed to be your practice, and you have to take so many jumps out of there. Nothing like what you're going through at all.
Yeah. And had you ever actually made a parachute jump before? Had you ever actually deployed a parachute?
Well, yes. We had three jumps that we had to take off a tower.
You knew how to pull the ripcord.
Yeah.
So you turn your P-38 upside down.
You drop out and count two or three and pull the cord.
And are you clenching your teeth and closing your eyes while you do this?
I don't remember what I did.
I mean, I can't imagine being in that situation. And are you still over enemy territory?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's kind of a big deal.
I landed right near a haystack. And somehow, and I don't know how I did this, but I got in there and got covered up. And they were all around me, but they didn't find me. And then that night, I just sneaked out and went across the lines and went home.
So this is in Italy?
Yeah.
And this is during daytime when you're coming down?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So you're floating down. That must have felt like a long time
coming
down.
Oh, my God, it just forever. Yeah. They're nasty people. They shoot at you when you're going down.
You were getting shot at?
Oh, yeah.
So you're coming down in a parachute in broad daylight in enemy-held territory, and you hear and see bullets coming past you.
Yes.
How close do you think they came?
Oh, I don't think. You could hear them, but I don't know. How close could you hear a bullet? 20 feet? 10 feet? I don't know. I don't think they were close.
Did you think you were going to survive this?
You don't think of it. You don't have time to think. You're thinking about where are you going to land and how are you going to hide.
Yeah.
That's what you're thinking about.
Did you have any control of where you were landing? I mean, are you guiding that parachute at all?
Oh, yeah. You can control where you're going.
Uh-huh.
But how do you know where you're going? I mean, and how do you know what's down there? So I was just lucky. I hit where there was a big straw stack or a haystack, and I buried in there, and they looked for me there, but they didn't find me.
So you come down. You take off your chute. You climb into this haystack. You drag your chute in there with you, I'm sure.
Yeah, cover
it
up.
You don't want to leave any evidence. And you say they were looking for you. How do you know?
I don't know. I stayed there a long time, and I know it was dark when I came out, and there was nobody around, so I sneaked back through the lines. And
when you're inside that itchy haystack, I'm sure it was itchy.
Well, you know, I don't remember that.
It had to be. Can you see anything?
Oh, no, no, no. It's blacker than Hades.
But you can hear stuff.
Oh, you can hear stuff, yeah. I know they were poking me with bayonets, but they didn't reach me, thank goodness.
So you hear voices.
Yeah.
And you hear the hay rustling, and you're imagining they're trying to see if anything's in there, stabbing you with the bayonet on the end of the rifle.
I'm sure they were poking at me, but I guess I was in far enough it didn't reach anyway.
And you're laughing about this, but you understand anybody who's listening and is trying to put themselves in your shoes is scared out of their mind right now.
Well, what good does it do to cry about it, you know?
What were you doing inside of that haystack?
Well, you dig like hell.
Just trying to get as far deep as you can.
Yeah, then you try to be quiet because you know they're looking for you. So.
And is it hard to breathe?
No, it wasn't hard to breathe.
It's all right.
Yeah.
Are you thinking about mom and dad back home?
No, the only thing you're thinking about is how am I going to get out of here? I don't know how long I laid there. Quite a while.
Hours?
Yeah.
Into the night?
Yeah. Come out and look around. There's nobody around, so you just take off.
Well, I imagine that. I mean, just for me, maybe you're immune to this, but for me, that would be awfully scary to come out.
Well,
not knowing what's out there.
You are, because you don't know what's out there.
And how'd you know where to go?
You have a compass.
And you had known from your briefings, you know where,
oh, yeah, yeah,
what you're photographing. You have a general idea,
yeah,
of where American forces might,
yeah,
be. So how far you think you had to go to get back on the American side of the lines?
Oh, I don't know, maybe a mile. That's kind of hard to say.
So you're doing this in the middle of the night?
Yeah, it seemed like it took a long time. Maybe I was being too careful, or I don't know.
I don't think you can be too careful in a situation.
But
like
there was
that.
Nobody around, and that's what surprised me, because they knew I went in that thing. It's a wonder they didn't burn it.
Good point.
You know,
good
really.
Point.
Yeah,
they could have lit it on fire in a hurry.
Yeah.
So, how did you know you were back on the American side?
Well, you got a pretty good idea, and you got maps. You know, you always carry a map.
At some point, you finally see, yeah, an American soldier.
Yeah.
I bet that felt pretty good.
Yeah. The thing that made me mad, though, is somebody had already taken my billet when I got back to base.
How long was it till you got back to base?
Probably a couple of days.
Uh-huh.
You know.
So they figured, hey, his plane
went
down,
they,
he's a goner.
Yeah, they knew I wasn't coming back.
I know you can laugh about it now, but it's an amazing story, isn't it?
It is, I guess, yeah. Different.
If you met somebody here in Visalia and they told you the story that you just told me, would you believe him?
I think it would depend on the guy, you know, depending on what he'd done and where he'd been. If it was just somebody off the street, you wouldn't know.
So if you can survive that, you can survive anything, right?
Sure. That's why I'm still here.
I guess so. 97 and going strong. So you kept flying those kind of missions the rest of the war?
Oh, yeah. Next day, you go back, you fly it again.
Did you have a favorite of the planes you flew? I mean, because you're probably flying different.
That's something that's hard to explain. But you can take five airplanes out there. Every one of them is different.
Mm-hmm.
It don't seem possible. They're all made the same way.
Yeah, you would know. You were making them.
They are. They're different. Every one of them fly different.
Uh-huh. So you got to feel it out,
yeah,
on the fly. And I don't want to only ask you about those two missions, the Purple Heart and the time you got shot down. Were there some other incidents that happened in some of those flights that stand out for you?
Oh, I guess. I got to tell you a funny one. This one time I come back, there was a big lake out there we flew over, mm-hmm, and there was a guy out there fishing. Well, you know, you should do things like this, but you're all tied up in a knot. And I thought, well, I'll go down and buzz that guy. Well, I scared the pee out of him. You know? I felt so bad about it afterwards.
Did he fall into the water or anything?
Oh, yeah, he jumped into the water.
Well, if he's still around, maybe he's been waiting all these years for you to fess up.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll never forget that, because he heard me coming.
Sure.
And he threw down, and next, and then I felt like a damn fool.
Conscience wouldn't let you live it down. How about this? You're out there flying all these unarmed missions, taking all these photographs, getting shot, putting your life in danger. What have you been able to figure out since as far as what those photographs were used for or what they meant to the cause?
The only thing I can hope is that they did some good. Other than that, you know, that's the only thing you can do is hope that it helped get the war over and kept other people from getting shot.
Well, and you say that, keep other people from getting shot. Did you lose any friends over there?
Oh, sure. Yeah, you don't like to think of it, but you do. Yeah, you lose people.
So what did it mean to you when Germany surrendered?
Just relief, I guess. It's over with, and let's go home. There was a base right by Mount Vesuvius. I think we spent a couple of months there waiting for transportation home. Finally, we came home with a B-17, but just had to wait till there was room, you know, to get on one.
And I know that you have a lot more experiences after World War II. But just when I think about what you've shared with me here, and I'm looking, and your son Paul is sitting 6 feet away here. You've got two sons, four grandkids, four great-grandkids. If you're still on the Arizona, they're never born. If that shrapnel inside your cockpit is a couple inches off,
yep,
they're not here. If they burn that haystack or catch you at any point in that incredible survival story you shared, being shot down, none of these people are ever born.
That's right.
How do you explain all that?
Fate. I guess everything is already arranged ahead of time. I don't think we have any control over it. So whatever the old man's got lined up for us up there, that's the way it's going to happen.
And I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I mean, it's your story. It's your life. Is that how you see it?
Yeah.
That somebody was pulling the strings for you?
Yeah.
Hard to explain it otherwise, huh?
How can you explain it?
And I guess that was the other question I had about your time in the haystack there that must have been so memorable. When you were in there, I mean, is that something? Do you sit there and pray? God,
oh,
help me survive this?
You pray. You're darn right. Anybody that's been through that, don't pray. You'll never convince me of that.
Here in this part of California, we don't see a lot of those big haystacks.
You
might see them baled in the field or, you know, the yellow butterflies coming out of the alfalfa.
Yeah.
But if you see a haystack today.
I haven't seen a haystack in years. You know, really.
You think if you did, it would trigger some memories for you?
I wouldn't be surprised, yeah.
But you wouldn't go crawling in, necessarily.
No, well, I wouldn't go in there to see what was in there.
There might be an American flyer still hiding
yeah.
out in there. So the war's over, and I'm sure you could have gotten out if you wanted to.
By that time, I had so many years in, I figured I might as well just stay and retire.
So what kinds of things did you do after World War II?
Well, I instructed, taught school.
What were you instructing?
AT-6s.
So you're training future fighter pilots.
Yeah.
Who went over to Korea and Vietnam. And you never met a plane that you liked better than the P-38? Because they've come up with a lot of planes, you know, since then.
No, I don't think so. It was really a wonderful airplane. There was no torque to it. It did what you wanted it to do. You know, most of your, well, like your single-engine planes, you got to have one leg stronger than the other. There was no torque in them or anything because they were counter-rotating props. It was just a beautiful airplane.
Did you feel like it was almost an extension of you?
Oh, yeah, you
do. You could control it that easily?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah, you do. You did. That's a good thought. You do. You just feel like you're just one.
When's the last time you flew in a P-38?
Right after the war, long time ago.
Close to 70 years.
Yeah. I think I can still fly it.
Not too long ago, you got to fly. You weren't in the cockpit, and you had several dozen other veterans with you going to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight to see the World War II Memorial. What was that experience like for you?
Being back there was wonderful. We really got to see some wonderful sights.
And one of them was the National World War II Memorial.
Yeah.
Where they've got 4,000 gold stars signifying 406,000 Americans who died. You knew a bunch of them who died on the first day of the war
yeah.
on the Arizona.
Well, you know, you just have to forget that. You can't dwell on stuff like that.
What did you think about while you were there?
Well, I guess I just kind of in awe.
Did you find yourself thinking about some of the guys you knew? Or
oh,
thinking
sure
about?
You do. Yeah. Absolutely. Some of your real good buddies, you know, yeah. Especially guys that I was in the Navy with. Not so much the Air Force, because you're not that close to anybody. In fact, as I told you about being in Las Vegas, well, Joe and I guess we bunked together for 2 or 3 years, and I never heard from him again. I really did try after the war. I tried to get a hold of him, and I just never could.
Your honor flight experience, getting back there and seeing everything is a highlight. But what about coming back home here? Did you enjoy the reception they had waiting for you?
Oh, yeah. That was a wonderful reception. We weren't expecting anything, you know. And then, my God, how many thousand people were there? Oh, that was really something.
You're 97. You've got a lot of history running around up in that brain. But most of the people alive today were not alive for World War II.
Yeah.
What do we need to know about it? What do we need to know about what you guys did and why you did it?
Don't get in another one. I think that's the big thing. I think that's the whole story. If we just keep people up there in Washington that aren't warmongers, there's got to be better ways to settle things than the way we did it.
I don't want to forget to thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us a pretty incredible story that only you could tell us. Is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
For being here, I guess.
What keeps you going at 97?
I don't know the secret.
Is there some, like, raw local honey out here in Visalia you
I don't know.
Lubricate yourself with? Or?
Well, she slapped my face. Oh, no, you're talking about something else.
You still got it. That was pretty quick. That looks like they could land in, what's that, corn growing out there?
Yeah.
Some young corn?
Yeah.
Somebody landed in that cornfield in a P-38 and said, you want to take off in this puppy?
Oh, I could take it off. You never forget. I know I could.
What about landing it?
Well, I'm not sure my depth perception is that good, but
you'd come down one way or the other.
Yeah, I think you'd be. Where is that ground?
Well, to bring this show to our final approach, I want to bring in Mr. Deming's son, Paul, who sat in on the interview. What is it, Paul, about your dad's story that you find most amazing?
Just the tenacity that he's gone all through all of his life. There's never been anything he couldn't do.
Did he tell you these stories when you were a kid?
A little bit. It was never something that was easy to share.
I imagine especially his connection to the USS Arizona is one that would have been difficult for him.
Yeah, I don't think we dug out that logbook maybe 10 years ago.
So your whole life you had no idea he'd been on the Arizona?
Get little pieces of it.
And then the story of bailing out of the P-38.
Yeah, that one we'd heard about, and it was always like, man, you're just crazy.
I mean, doesn't that sound like something from a movie?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not supposed to happen.
No.
And again, I'm not trying to be melodramatic, but it's a real thing. If he doesn't survive all those things, you're not here.
Right.
How does that make you feel about him and what he's done and who he is?
Well, I just think that whole group of guys, they had a job. They weren't overdramatic about it. They got it done. Mm-hmm. And they kept moving. And, you know, the result's been that, you know, we all live in a pretty peaceful place.
And I asked him about the honor flight experience a little bit. You were his guardian on that flight. What did you get out of all that?
I was just amazed, you know, watching all of them together. You know, I'd never seen younger people that were so patriotic and coming up to all of these guys and really genuinely thanking them, going out of their way for what they did. You know, when you're close to it, you don't see that. But, you know, it was really impressive. Anybody that's even questioning whether to go on something like that, they've got to go. It's a fantastic experience.
And you say that about the young people, and it reminds me, you know, everyone assumes that this is only about celebrating the past, but I think it's also about informing and inspiring the future.
Right.
Anything else you want to say about this guy?
Oh, no. He's my best friend, and I'm just glad you were able to get down here and talk him into this.
Yeah. Good work. How much did you offer him?
We'll talk later.
Well, it's good to know that sense of humor got passed on to the next generation. Thanks to Paul and, of course, his father, 97-year-old Sim Deming. Check out those photos and videos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses going to your heart, you just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.